Chapter 6. They paused near North Andover, standing on a pedestrian overpass above Route 495. The clouds were thickening again, but the moon broke through long enough to show them six lanes of silent traffic. Near the bridge where they stood, in the southbound lanes, an overturned 16-wheeler lay like a dead elephant. Orange pylons had been set up around it, showing that someone had made at least a token response, and there were two abandoned police cruisers beyond them, one on its side. The rear half of the truck had been burned black. There was no sign of bodies, not in the momentary moonlight. A few people labored westward in the breakdown lane, but it was slow going even there.
"Kind of makes it all real, doesn't it?" Tom said.
"No," Alice said. She sounded indifferent.
"To me it looks like a special effect in some big summer movie. Buy a bucket of popcorn and a Coke and watch the end of the world and, what do they call it? Computer graphic imaging, CGI, blue screen, some fucking thing."
She held up the little sneaker by one lace.
"This is all I need to make it real. Something small enough to hold in my hand. Come on, let's go."
Chapter 7. There were plenty of abandoned vehicles on Highway 28, but it was wide open compared to 495, and by 4 o'clock they were nearing Methuen, hometown of Mr. Roscoe Hant, he of the stereo flashlights. And they believed enough of Hant's story to want to be undercover well before daylight. They chose a motel at the intersection of 28 and 110. A dozen or so cars were parked in front of the various units, but to Clay they had an abandoned feel. And why wouldn't they? The two roads were passable, but only if you were on foot. Clay and Tom stood at the edge of the parking lot, waving their flashlights over their heads.
"We're okay," Tom called. "Normal folks. Coming in."
They waited. There was no response from what the sign identified as the Sweet Valley Inn, heated pool, HBO, group rates.
"Come on," Alice said. "My feet hurt. And it'll be getting light soon, won't it?"
"Look at this," Clay said. He picked up a CD from the motel's turn-in and shone the beam of his flashlight on it. It was Love Songs by Michael Bolton.
"And you said they were getting smarter," Tom said.
"Don't be so quick to judge," Clay said as they started toward the units. "Whoever had it threw it away, right?"
"More likely just dropped it," Tom said.
Alice shone her own light on the CD.
"Who is this guy?"
"Honey Bunch," Tom said.
"You don't want to know." He took the CD and tossed it back over his shoulder. They forced the doors on three adjoining units as gently as possible so they could at least shoot the bolts once they were inside, and with beds to sleep in, they slept most of the day away. They were not disturbed, although that evening Alice said she thought she had heard music coming from far away. But she admitted it might have been part of a dream she was having. Chapter 8. There were maps for sale in the lobby of the Sweet Valley Inn that would offer more detail than their road atlas. They were in a glass display cabinet that had been smashed. Clay took one for Massachusetts and one for New Hampshire, reaching in carefully so as not to cut his hand, and saw a young man lying on the other side of the reception counter as he did so. His eyes glared sightlessly. For a moment, Clay thought someone had put an oddly colored corsage in the corpse's mouth. Then he saw the greenish points poking out through the dead man's cheeks and realized they matched the broken glass littering the shelves of the display cabinet. The corpse was wearing a name tag that said, "My name is Hank. Ask me about weekly rates." Clay thought briefly of Mr. Riccardi as he looked at Hank. Tom and Alice were waiting for him just inside the lobby door. It was 9:15, and outside it was full dark.
"How did you do?" Alice asked.
"These may help," he said. He gave her the maps, then lifted the Coleman lantern so she and Tom could study them, compare them against the road atlas, and plot the night's travel. He was trying to cultivate a sense of fatalism about Johnny and Sharon, trying to keep the bald truth of his current family situation front and center in his mind. What had happened in Kent Pond had happened. His son and his wife were either all right, or they weren't. He would either find them, or he wouldn't. His success at this sort of semi-magical thinking came and went. When it started slipping, he told himself he was lucky to be alive, and this was certainly true. What balanced his good luck out was that he'd been in Boston, 150 miles south of Kent Pond by even the quickest route, which they were definitely not taking, when the pulse happened. And yet he'd fallen in with good people. There was that. People he could think of as friends. He'd seen plenty of others, beer keg guy and plump Bible-toting lady, as well as Mr. Roscoe Hant of Methuen, who weren't as lucky. If he got to you, Cher, if Johnny got to you, you better be taking care of him. You just better be. But suppose he'd had his phone. Suppose he'd taken the red cell phone to school.
Might he not have been
taking it a little more often lately? Because so many of the other kids took theirs? Christ. Clay? You all right? Tom asked. Sure. Why? I don't know. You looked a little grim. Dead guy behind the counter. He's not pretty. Look here, Alice said, tracing a thread on the map. It squiggled across the state line and then appeared to join New Hampshire Route 38, a little east of Pelham. That looks pretty good to me, she said. If we go west on the highway out there for 8 or 9 miles, she pointed at 110, where both the cars and the tar were gleaming faintly in a misty drizzle. We should hit it. What do you think? I think that sounds good, Tom said. She looked from him to Clay anxiously. The little sneaker was put away, probably in her backpack, but Clay could see her wanting to squeeze it. He supposed it was good she wasn't a smoker. She'd be up to 4 packs a day. If they've got the way across guarded, she began. We'll worry about that if we have to, Clay said, but he wasn't worrying. One way or another, he was getting to Maine. If it meant crawling through some pucker brush, like an illegal crossing the Canadian border to pick apples in October, he would do it. If Tom and Alice decided to stay behind, that would be too bad. He'd be sorry to leave them, but he would go, because he had to know. The red squiggle Alice had found on the Sweet Valley maps had a name, Dosty Stream Road, and it was almost wide open. It was a 4-mile hike to the state line, and they came upon no more than 5 or 6 abandoned vehicles and only a single wreck. They also passed 2 houses where they could see lights and hear the roar of generators. They considered stopping at these, but not for long. We'd probably get into a firefight with some guy defending his hearth and home, Clay said, always assuming there's anyone there. Those generators were probably set to come on when the county juice failed, and they'll run until they're out of gas. Even if there are sane people and they let us in, which would hardly be a sane act, what are we going to do? Tom said. Ask to use the phone? They discussed stopping somewhere and trying to liberate a vehicle. Liberate was Tom's word, but in the end decided against that too. If the state line was being defended by deputies or vigilantes, driving up to it in a Chevy Tahoe might not be the smoothest move. So they walked. And of course, there was nothing at the state line but a billboard. A small one, as befitted a 2-lane blacktop road winding through farm country, reading, "You are now entering New Hampshire," and "Bienvenue." There was no sound but the drip of moisture in the woods on either side of them, and an occasional sigh of breeze, maybe the rustle of an animal. They stopped briefly to read the sign, and then walked on, leaving Massachusetts behind. Chapter 9. Any sense of being alone ended along with the Dosty Stream Road, at a signpost reading New Hampshire Route 38, and Manchester, 19 miles. There were still only a few travelers on 38, but when they switched to 128, a wide, wreck-littered road that headed almost due north, half an hour later, that trickle became part of a steady stream of refugees. They traveled mostly in little groups of 3 and 4, and with what struck Clay as a rather shabby lack of interest in anyone other than themselves. They encountered a woman of about 40 and a man maybe 20 years older, pushing shopping carts, each containing a child. The one in the man's cart was a boy and too big for the conveyance, but he had found a way to curl up inside and fall asleep. While Clay and his party were passing this jackleg family, a wheel came off the man's shopping cart. It tipped sideways, spilling out the boy, who looked about 7. Tom caught him by the shoulder and broke the worst of the kid's fall, but he scraped 1 knee, and of course he was frightened. Tom picked him up, but the boy didn't know him and struggled to get away, crying harder than ever. That's okay, thanks. I've got him, the man said. He took the child and sat down at the side of the road with him, where he made much of what he called the boo-boo, a term Clay didn't think he'd heard since he was 7. The man said, Gregory, kiss it. Make it all better. He kissed the child's scrape, and the boy laid his head against the man's shoulder. He was already going to sleep again. Gregory smiled at Tom and Clay and nodded. He looked weary almost to death, a man who might have been a trim and nautilus-toned 60 last week, and now looked like a 75-year-old Jew trying to get the hell out of Poland while there was still time. We'll be all right, he said. You can go now. Clay opened his mouth to say, Why shouldn't we all go on together? Why don't we hook up? What do you think, Greg? It was the sort of thing the heroes of the science fiction novels he'd read as a teenager were always saying. Why don't we hook up? Yeah, go on. What are you waiting for? The woman asked before he could say that, or anything else. In her shopping cart, a girl of about 5 still slept. The woman stood beside the cart protectively, as if she had grabbed some fabulous sale item and was afraid Clay or one of his friends might try to wrest it from her. You think we got something you want? Natalie, stop, Gregory said with tired patience. But Natalie didn't, and Clay realized what was so dispiriting about this little scene. Not that he was getting his lunch, his midnight lunch, fed to him by a woman whose exhaustion and terror had led to paranoia. That was understandable and forgivable. What made his spirits sink to his shoe tops was the way people just kept on walking, swinging their flashlights, and talking low among themselves in their own little groups, swapping the occasional suitcase from one hand to the other. Some yob on a pocket rocket motorbike wove his way up the road between the wrecks and over the litter, and people made way for him, muttering resentfully. Clay thought it would have been the same if the little boy had fallen out of the shopping cart and broken his neck instead of just scraping his knee. He thought it would have been the same if that heavyset guy up there panting along the side of the road with an overloaded duffel bag dropped with a thunderclap coronary. No one would try to resuscitate him, and of course the days of 911 were done. No one even bothered to yell, "You tell him, lady," or, "Hey, dude, why don't you tell her to shut up?" They just went on walking. "'Cause all we got is these kids, a responsibility we didn't ask for when we can hardly take care of ourselves. He has a pacemaker. What are we supposed to do when the battery runs out, I'd like to know? And now these kids? You want a kid?" She looked around wildly. "Hey, anyone want a kid?" The little girl began to stir. "Natalie, you're disturbing Portia," Gregory said. The woman named Natalie began to laugh. "Well, tough shit. It's a disturbing-ass world." Around them, people continued doing the refugee walk. No one paid any attention, and Clay thought, so this is how we act. This is how it goes when the bottom drops out. When there are no cameras turning, no buildings burning, no Anderson Cooper saying, now back to the CNN studios in Atlanta. This is how it goes when Homeland Security's been canceled due to lack of sanity. Let me take the boy, Clay said. I'll carry him until you find something better to put him in. That cart's shot. He looked at Tom. Tom shrugged and nodded. Stay away from us, Natalie said. And all at once there was a gun in her hand. It wasn't a big one, probably only a .22, but even a .22 would do the job if the bullet went in the right place. Clay heard the sound of guns being drawn on either side of him, and knew that Tom and Alice were now pointing the pistols they'd taken from the Nickerson home at the woman named Natalie. This was also how it went, it seemed. Put it away, Natalie, he said. We're going to get moving now.
You're double fucking right you are,
she said, and brushed an errant lock of hair out of her eye with the heel of her free hand. She didn't seem to be aware that the young man and younger woman with Clay were holding guns on her. Now people passing by did look, but their only response was to move past the spot of confrontation and potential bloodshed a little faster. Come on, Clay, Alice said quietly. She put her free hand on his wrist. Before someone gets shot. They started walking again. Alice walked with her hand on Clay's wrist, almost as if he were her boyfriend. Just a little midnight stroll, Clay thought, although he had no idea of what time it was and didn't care. His heart was beating hard. Tom walked with them, only until they were around the next curve he walked backward, with his gun still out. Clay supposed Tom wanted to be ready to shoot back if Natalie decided to use her little pop gun after all. Because shooting back was also how it went. now that phone service had been interrupted until further notice. Chapter 10. In the hours before dawn, walking on Route 102 east of Manchester, they began to hear music, very faint.
"Christ," Tom said, coming to a stop. "That's Baby Elephant Walk."
"It's what?" Alice asked. She sounded amused.
"A big band instrumental from the age of Quarter Gas. Les Brown and his Band of Renown, someone like that. My mother had the record."
Two men pulled even with them and stopped for a blow. They were elderly, but both looked fit. Like a couple of recently retired postmen hiking the Cotswolds, Clay thought. Wherever they are. One wore a pack, no pussy day pack either, but the waist-length kind on a frame, and the other had a rucksack hanging from his right shoulder. Hung over the left was what looked like a 30-30. Packsack wiped sweat from his seamed forehead with a forearm and said,
"Your mama might have had a version by Les Brown, son, but more likely it was Don Costa or Henry Mancini. Those were the popular ones. That one," he inclined his head toward the ghostly strains, "that's Lawrence Welk, as I live and breathe."
"Lawrence Welk?" Tom breathed, almost in awe.
"Who?"
Alice asked. "Listen to that elephant walk," Clay said, and laughed. He was tired and feeling goofy. It occurred to him that Johnny would love that music. Packsack gave him a glance of passing contempt, then looked back at Tom.
"That's Lawrence Welk, all right," he said. "My eyes aren't half right anymore, but my ears are fine. My wife and I used to watch his show every fucking Saturday night."
"Dodge had a good time, too," Rucksack said. It was his only addition to the conversation, and Clay hadn't the slightest idea what it meant.
"Lawrence Welk and his champagne band," Tom said. "Think of it."
"Lawrence Welk and his champagne music makers," Packsack said. "Jesus Christ."
"Don't forget the Lennon sisters and the lovely Alice Lawn," Tom said. In the distance, the ghostly music changed.
"That one's Calcutta," Packsack said.
He sighed.
"Well, we'll be getting along. Nice passing the time of day with you."
"Night," Clay said.
"Nope," Packsack said. "These are our days now. Haven't you noticed?" "Have a good one, boys. You too, little ma'am."
"Thank you," the little ma'am standing between Clay and Tom said faintly. Packsack started along again. Rucksack fell sturdily in beside him. Around them, a steady parade of bobbing flashlight beams led people deeper into New Hampshire. Then Packsack stopped and looked back for a final word.
"You don't want to be on the road more than another hour," he said. "Find a house or motel unit and get inside. You know about the shoes, right?"
"What about the shoes?" Tom asked. Packsack looked at him patiently, the way he'd probably look at anyone who couldn't help being a fool. Far down the road, Calcutta, if that's what it was, had given way to a polka. It sounded insane in the foggy, drizzly night. And now this old man with the big pack on his back was talking about shoes.
"When you go inside a place, you put your shoes out on the stoop," Packsack said. "The crazy ones won't take them, don't worry about that. And it tells other people the place is taken and to move along, find another.
Saves—" his eyes dropped to the heavy automatic weapon Clay was carrying.
"Saves accidents."
"Have there been accidents?" Tom asked.
"Oh, yes," Packsack said, with chilling indifference. "There's always accidents, people being what they are. But there's plenty of places, so there's no need for you to have one. Just put out your shoes."
"How do you know that?" Alice asked. He gave her a smile that improved his face out of all measure. But it was hard not to smile at Alice. She was young, and even at 3 in the morning she was pretty.
"People talk, I listen. I talk, sometimes other folks listen. Did you listen?"
"Yes," Alice said. "Listening's one of my best things."
"Then pass it on. Bad enough to have them to contend with."
He didn't have to be more specific.
"Too bad to have accidents among ourselves on top of that."
Clay thought of Natalie pointing the .22. He said, "You're right, thank you." Tom said,
"That one's the beer barrel polka, isn't it?"
"That's right, son," Packsack said. "Myron Florin on the squeeze box, God rest his soul. You might want to stop in Gayton. It's a nice little village 2 miles or so up the road.
Is that where you're going to stay?
Alice asked. Me and Rolf might push on a dite further, he said.
Why?
Because we can, little ma'am, that's all. You have a good day.
This time they didn't contradict him, and although the two men had to be pushing 70, they were soon out of sight, following the beam of a single flashlight which Rucksack, Rolf, held.
Lawrence Welk and his champagne music makers, Tom marveled.
Baby elephant walk, Clay said, and laughed.
Why did Dodge have a good time, too?
Alice wanted to know.
Because it could, I guess, Tom said,
and burst out laughing at her perplexed expression.